You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. Live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't decide.
The Goo Goo Dolls, here on your 50,000 watt music mother of Orange County, California. Yeah. Speeding it up for all you couples out there. If you're at work, go ahead and grab your girl or your guy, whichever you prefer, and let it rip. All Marine Radio, putting the fun in the workday. We'll slow it down here in a few minutes. Joining me now, Tim Lynch, former doctor, United States Navy. Timmy, what's up?
Not much, Mac. Nice lead in. That sounded great.
Let me tell you, one of the things that that used to make me laugh was, like, I got involved in doing radio, right? And I had no training in it, though. I just was, you know, fairly adept at rhetoric and logic, and I followed current events, so doing talk radio was not difficult for me. But I'd be talking about people that were not of my tribe. So the people that tend to work at radio stations are the audio-visual geeks from high school, right? The kids that started doing, you know, the lunchtime radio show. Hey, everybody, Estancia High School, this is the big boofa, or whatever they called themselves, right? Breaking it down for you, blah, those people. And then they start in local radio, and you meet them. And, oh, my God. But they would do that, like, Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. And they would do all that shit. And I would sit there, and I would laugh my ass off. So,
yeah, that always drove me crazy to listen to, too.
You should be around them.
Yeah. I used to go on with Jim Longo, who's a drive-time DJ down in Corpus Christi. But he's a Vietnam vet. Real low key, and it was a lot like talking with you. It was fun.
No, that's not the people that I found most amusing and entertaining. They were like radio people. Hey, what's going on, Denny Johnson here in the morning? I would tell them, hey, do some like radio stuff, and they would. They would like, all right, here you go, wah, and they'd let it rip. I thought that was amusing. We had two guys. I think while I was in Iraq one of those times, they took over one of my hours. And they were both really fat guys. And they called their show A Ton of Fun at One. they used to do, like, fat guy humor. They were hilarious, man. And so they'd, like, bring me on and then make fun of me. Oh, Mac, you know you should be on the show, right? Like, yeah, I know. You're not a fat guy. I'm like, I know. Like, why you say it like that? Like, you're going to be belligerent with me? And they're like, no, but, you know, come on. We just want to keep it real with you. I'm like, all right. But it was funny. Hey, I want to, on a serious note, I want to talk about your involvement in Beirut. Tell everybody what you were doing and when you got to the Med and how you got to Beirut. So tell everybody that story.
Yeah, so on Sunday morning, October 23rd, it was at dawn, I was driving into the Naval Hospital in Newport, Rhode Island, where I was a laboratory technician because I had duty that day. And I remember it was a beautiful day, and the sun was coming up, and I heard the news of what had happened, and I was like, whoa, this could have, this is, this, I was just, I was so upset. because nobody saw that one coming. You know, I couldn't understand it. And
the truth is, right, to me, it's a watershed event in American history in terms of the world had changed. We hadn't really noticed it. Not sure if we should have or could have or would have or whatnot, because it was something that was asymmetrical, foreign to us.
Oh yeah,
and a watershed event.
Yeah, and then within days it became apparent that we were going to get swept up in the response to this. Now, what had happened was a BLT battalion landing team headquarters 1-8 had been blown up by a truck bomb, probably the largest truck bomb to ever go off at that point. The response was immediate from the Mediterranean's fleet, and the initial rush of casualties were eventually got out of there. They were reconstituted, but they were anticipating some more fighting, and so they plussed up the MAU at the time going over, the Marine Amphibious Unit, with a large surgical team out of Norfolk, and then a small team out of Newport, Rhode Island. Our team was two surgeons, one of whom was an OBGYN surgeon, but a general surgeon all the same. He was a team leader who was dying to get out of the hospital. God, he hated delivering babies. He delivered Megan eventually. But he was a leader. There was another a doctor. There was a male nurse. There was myself and two corpsmen who were basically new guys. I didn't work with them. I didn't know them well. And we got sent over ahead of the MAU to Sicily, but then Grenada happened. And so they got diverted and went to Grenada. We got put in a motel outside of Sigonella Air Base, where this doctor in charge was convinced we were a terrorist target, and we were restricted to the hotel for a week. It was such a drag. And the other surgeon goes, oh, bullshit. And he went and vacationed. So he went off for a week to Sicily. We sat there and waited. Eventually, we got a chance to go around on a tour. And then we flew to Cyprus, flew out to the ship, and we sat off the coast of Beirut there. I went ashore once, which was remarkable because the CO of the ship was pissed at me. But I went ashore once in an attempt to try to find the source of a serious typhoid outbreak, which was damn near killed a couple of Marines. We had to medevac people in comas. I mean, it was positive blood cultures, positive spinal fluid cultures. I flew back from Wiesbaden.
Hold on. I'm confused. So they sent you ashore to be like the MAU CDC, Center for Disease Control,
and you were going to take out your magnifying glass
and find out where the typhus epidemic was?
No. They have within the medical community, there's medical intelligence teams, there are environmental health teams, and these guys are ashore specifically to monitor these kind of things. But what they don't have with them, it was a lieutenant colonel, a lieutenant, a second class petty officer. They didn't have a lab, but they didn't have any microbiology laboratory equipment. What I had was the ability to come ashore, sample where they suspected this stuff was, bring it back to the ship, put it in the auger and grow it, and then tell them what the hell it is that it was growing. That was my sole responsibility.
Got it.
And in that, I got to sit on top of a building, drinking martinis, watching the firefights all night. It was my little time ashore was quite eventful.
Now what? So when did you go ashore? What time period?
That was January of 1984. And prior to that, you know, we had casualties and drips and drabs. But
right,
one of the things that I'll never forget was a night when a Marine Corps squad. This is what makes me nervous about the Syria thing. Lieutenant Colonel Smith had set a very aggressive posture, and he took his best platoon and kicked them out to the American University, and he took his best squad and put them on top of a hotel. And they established an OP, as my understanding. The guy I'm talking about is ETOR.
Right.
And so one night, a 155 round, they hit him smack dab on the top of that hotel. And so I believe 4 KIA, 8 severely wounded. It was a mess, right? And so, right, you know, our role in that, and my role in that one was as a lab guy. I'm sitting, this is the OPH, right? So you've got two operating rooms. You've got a medical ward, which they were using for the worst of the bleeders. And then the rest of the guys are lined out on stretcher, on carriers, on stretchers. And I've got the walking blood bank. you know, coming around the whole O2 level. Sorry, I hate this storm. But it was cool because the sailors and Marines that were there, as they needed blood in the OR, they would shout out to me, and I would shout out to this admin guy who would rearrange people by blood type. Then I would draw the blood, and they're on the stretcher right next to the Marines. You know, it was so emotional.
No, you know, Timmy, I wasn't in Fallujah Surgical when it happened, but General Furness, Lieutenant Colonel at the time, he's a CO-11. He was headed back to Camp Fallujah from a place that was in his area of operation called Karma. He went by to pick up somebody at a firm base they were building between on a rat line on a road that we thought that the shitheads were using. So we were building a firm base in there to deny them use of it. And so what had happened the days and previous to this was the bad guys had gone out and they had shot some mortars for the purpose of sinking base plates. Okay. Now, the importance of sinking base plates is once the base plate is sunk, the mortar's pretty accurate. So they sunk the base plates, and they waited for General Furness and his PSD to get in this firm base. So you had the Marines that were guarding it. You had the combat engineers that were working in there and building it. And then you had General Furness's PSD. I want to say they dropped 13 120-millimeter mortars inside and around the firm base. And so we were executing a mass casualty. I want to say probably one of the four that I was ever involved in. And you had every aviation platform in the area. You had every heading to this area. It was northwest of Abu Ghraib and southeast of Karma. And they drop in, bodies get thrown on, for me, I'm running it. One of my best friends is there. You don't know if he's dead or alive. And I can feel the helicopters coming. I can, you know, feel the building vibrate as they're coming over to land at Fallujah Surgical. They open the blood bank. And, I mean, it's something, you know, that still, you know, makes me get emotional is announcing who needed blood and Marines, you know, throwing their hand up in the air, grabbing their rifle and say, hold on, who's good cover for him doing, you know, clearing arty missions, right? Sir, hold on. Okay. Don't go anywhere till that guy gets here and then leave. And then seeing Marines grab their rifle, grab their helmet and sprinting to Fallujah Surgical to give somebody else their blood. And, you know, Fallujah Surgical is kind of a sacred place. I mean, a lot of Marines went there. A lot of Marines died there. A lot of Marines got saved there. But there is no, I don't even know how to put it in words. You know, you're around them, and they're the roughest, toughest, most shit-talking group you've ever seen. Under fire, they're the bravest people you've ever seen. And when somebody needs them, they're the most selfless people you've ever seen. And, you know, they don't ask. Right? They'll come and they'll die, and it's the most intoxicating experience in the world. And to watch them run to give their blood, I've seen it maybe three times in my life, you know, during mass casualty events, and it's breathtaking. Their selflessness and courage.
And it's the emotion that you were seeing because, you know, we're on a ship, so the whole O2 level is packed with hundreds of people want to give their blood. And so, you know, they're laying in a stretcher. In some cases, they're holding the hands of the Marine that the blood's going into.
Right.
And it was just so, at the time, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. We were moving. It was a long time to get through all those patients. Then we had to package the dead. And by the time we were done, you know, your boots are squishy. There's so much blood all over the place. It was a mess. But the reason I mention it is, When you hang people out there, I don't know that I've got the story right. We'll have to ask Mike about this because I've talked to Etor about this. He remembers this obviously well.
Well, Mike was on. But, so just so everybody knows, right? Mike Etor, who comes on the program, who we served with at the basic school, and know He's a great guy. He's a prior enlisted drill instructor as a corporal, if you can imagine that. That's what kind of guy he is, though. And runs Fidelis Advising Consulting, I think. And yeah. and if you're on LinkedIn and you're friends with Mike, you see the things he publishes on a regular basis, and he's talking about leadership and he's teaching leadership around the country. And so, Mike is, he's been that guy forever. And he, but, you know, just like the story I just told where one of your friends is on one end of it and you're on the other, right? Timmy has the same experience with Mike Etor, you know, on different ends of the same event.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the thing about that is, and I'm not saying that this was Mike's intention, but the deployment in Beirut was basically, we're going to put a bunch of guys in here. We're going to set them up. But you're not going to shoot at us because we're America, and the USS New Jersey is right offshore, and we're going to kill you if you shoot at us. But every once in a while, they shoot at you anyway, right. You know. And sometimes they're good. And whoever was manning that 155 piece, that was not like they bracketed them and they took their time to get them. They smacked them one round, boom, right on top. It was a hell of a shot, or it might have been a Tinian shot. It was a horrible event for us. But that's the price you pay. And I don't say that because you look at Beirut and say, well, what was that worth? I mean, those guys gave their lives. No. Those Marines were in October 1983. Every Marine wanted to be the guy that was in Beirut. I mean, if there's action, that's where we want to be. It doesn't matter that what we ultimately were trying to achieve was bullshit. I mean, this Beirut situation,
well,
we should have never been in there.
I think it. Later, to me, it does. I mean, at the time, you're right. I mean, we're Marines, and you go where you go, and you're serving, and you know, but later on, as you get older, and you go down Smedley Butler's Road, and you say, what are we doing? You know, like, look, they'll go. And I said this yesterday out of Camp Wilkland when I was talking to 1-6. I said, you know what? If you're ever fortunate enough to see it, you'll see nobody fights like Marines do. You get in trouble, they'll come and they'll die. They don't ask. They don't play 50 questions with you either. They'll come and they're swinging a chain and they'll die. And it's the most amazing thing you've ever seen in your life. And it's that's why this DNA is so unique. And I link it to that's why the truth that comes out of this DNA is so unique. And that's what this is. This is the truth that comes out of the enlisted side of the Marine Corps that's been handed down orally, generation to generation to generation. I'm just here to give it to you with a louder amplifier. Okay. And so that's how that kind of gets linked.
It's true. And I could tell you, I've talked about this. I didn't know Mike Etor at the time. Obviously, I was just a second-class petty officer out on a ship. But I talked to Etor about this. I've talked to lieutenants about this. I've talked about this event multiple occasions, never got emotional. I'm inclined to say, hey, I think I need an estrogen blocker because I'm embarrassed. But the beauty of being on All Marine Radio is I think it'll give me a pass.
No, look, man. I mean, first of all, if it doesn't bother you, that's what should concern you. I mean, let me tell you, when you think of those things and the things that you've seen and how does it not bother you? Yet, right, for some in our brains, it's not supposed to bother us somehow or other. We're supposed to be made of something that allows you to live through shit like that and have it not bother you. Yeah, I'm good. Not.
Yeah. Still, I don't like being that emotional on the radio. But,
oh, really? Well, sucks to be you, pussy boy.
Hold on a second. I don't know.
I like that it's somebody else being emotional instead of me. I'm all about it. Go ahead, Timmy.
Well, no. A quick C story. I had mentioned the CO of the ship was pissed at me. You know, before this all, I mean, right before Christmas, we had a casualty come in. We never knew how many. You know, we just we'd stand by for casualties. This elevator comes down. It's one guy. I'm like, wow, what the hell? And we bring him over. This guy's missing a good part of his right hand and his left or right foot, a good part of a foot. So he's missing a hand and foot. What it turned out was he was a PAO off the USS New Jersey who had got on a 53 to go ashore. The pilots could have sworn somebody shot an RPG at him, and he skipped the tail rotor off the Atermat, and it fragmented and came through the compartment, missed both the crew chiefs, but hit him, right? That, wow. So that's what he was injured by.
Wow.
But as only one guy, I took him, I'm taking off his other boot, and I'm like, holy shit. And the doctor's like, what? I said, look at his other foot. Because it was clean. It was like clean. His nails were clipped and shit like that. It didn't smell bad. I said, dude, look at your foot. It's like clean. I said, are you gay? And it was a way of trying to keep his mind off the fact that he's missing a good part of his hand and his foot. And he's like, no, I just came off. And he was mortified that I caught him with clean feet. Anyway, fast forward to Christmas Eve. Brooke Shields, Bob Hope, and Jillian, everybody's there. And we've got a couple guys sitting up in the sick bay who'd been shot, but not bad enough to get medevaced. And Colonel Smith was rather insistent. They come back ashore. They're not going anywhere. He was very insistent about that. And so there's a couple of guys out there, a machine gunner had taken a round down the leg. I called him second best because the guy that got him was better. But and there was this kid, the sergeant, because all the medevacs were frozen over Christmas back then. Plus Bob Hope was there. So he says to me on Christmas Eve, he goes, you think Brooke Shields will come in and talk to me? I'm like, no, dude. Why would she talk to you? You got injured by a helicopter accident. She wants to talk to second best. And besides, you're gay. And he starts crying. And I'm like, dude, I'm kidding. And he goes, no. And I mean, he was really upset about this because everybody had been teasing him about being gay ever since I said that. And he wasn't. So I moved him into the ICU. I said, I'm going to hook you up. I cover his head in bandages in his chest. I put blood on him. I set the EKG leads. I give him an oxygen mask. No oxygen because I'm not a doctor. And I got them all cranked up there. I said, wait till they come by. And so they come strolling on by, and Brooke Shields looks in and recoils in horror. But Ann Jillian comes in and goes, what happened? I make up some bullshit story about him stepping on mine, rescuing kids. He's going to die, blah, blah, blah. And she wedges herself in between this thing. Now, keep in mind, the ICU's two beds. There's an illegal washer and dryer in the head there that runs anytime there's no patients because, you know, you don't want to use the ship's laundry and we're corpsmen. So the dryer's running constantly. So it's hot as hell in there. And I've only got a sheet over the kid, and she starts stroking his blood-matted hair. And, oh, my God, I never thought about this. He's a wretched. Just boom, stands straight up. I'm like, oh, my God, he's got a priapism, man. You've got to get out of here. I think there's something wrong. And I almost got her out the door before the ship's surgeon comes by and looks in and goes, what the fuck are you doing, Lynch? And I had to confess the whole thing. Oh, my God. It was a drag.
That was not very smart.
Nah, I couldn't believe it. I should have thought that one through.
Yeah,
I still got a short.
What I want to talk about Berger, but I don't want to talk about Berger without Jeff being here. But I guess there's a couple things that I listened to that I'd be curious about your thoughts. The hold on a second. I found it kind of interesting, some of the things that he said in there. The Marine Corps is not optimized for great power competition. It's not optimized to operate with the Navy. It skewed itself to be, a second land army. He considers it his, the way the Commandant influences the Marine Corps is by force design, right? And designing the Naval Expeditionary Force that supports the joint force in terms of requirement around the world. His vision is beyond 20 years. What is the Marine Corps? What does the Marine Corps need to look like in 20 years, and then we'll reverse engineer it to today? We won't have a vision of today to attempt to engineer it for 20 years in the future, which is kind of interesting. He foresees the Marine Corps undergoing large changes, specifically in the force design area, and its posture around the world, which to me sounds like more forward deployed. All right, and then he says, we need to set the pace. We need to be innovative. We need to be out there making them, right, respond to us. We don't respond to them. And then he believes the Marine Corps, ought to be at the head of that. And that his horizon is a 10-year planning horizon, which is also kind of interesting. He also talked about integrated naval force. That Marines ought to be an extension of the ship's magazine. So I just So that's kind of some of his general thoughts. And so without Jeff here, give me your thoughts relative to his vision and his design on the Marine Corps.
As I was listening to him talk yesterday, I could understand what he was articulating. I can understand what it makes sense, and I can understand how if you're perceiving China as the big peer adversary, how matching how the Chinese deploy their influence, because like what is military other than politics by another means? I could see matching it. I don't see how you can possibly do this with an active duty only force. Now, I can see having them. Let's talk the Pacific specifically. Let's talk denial.
When you say I don't see how you can do this, what are you referring to?
I'm talking about being able. He's talking like having miniature base. What the hell we used to call them? Base defense battalions back in World War II. Miniature base battalion setup. That's able to transition through multiple points and is somewhat fluid through and this is what I mean by only a military force. If you're talking about strong pointing certain areas of key terrain in the Asian Pacific with weapons that are designed such as GPS jammers, I mean jammers are the most relevant and the easiest to do and whatnot. That's not an active duty Marine mission. That's you're going to need contractors for that. And I don't see how you blend this small dispersed lethal force all through this area. To me, you can't. The only way you can do that is by setting up something like the East India Company, like the Brits, where you've got a Marine active duty component and you've got another component whose job it is to be out there doing things. Make them USAID implementers. Make them businessmen. Jesus, we could do it.
I don't even understand what you're saying. We're talking about active duty guys that are forward deployed.
No. The active, if in order for the comrade to be that flexible moving around in that kind of environment, he has to have trusted agents forward deployed.
You need to listen again. He's talking about using us, using Marines in the expeditionary role that they will go and set up in an expeditionary manner, whether it be a missile site to extend the magazine, whether it be a forward refueling point for the joint force, but the naval force's responsibility relative to the joint force and the expeditionary capability in support of either logistics, comm requirements, or the expeditionary force as an extension of the ship's magazine. So I don't see contractors playing in that at all.
Because somebody's got to be there. Unless you're talking about you're just going to set up here. We're going to set up. We're going to break down and move. Locals be damned.
I think that's what he's talking about. If you're talking about some kind of fixed site, that's not what he's talking about.
No, I'm not talking fixed site. I'm talking fixed people in these locations who know the lay of the land and know the locals.
You're talking about a fixed site then, Timmy. And I don't think he's talking about that because he can't predict. Right? He can't predict where the hot point is going to be.
Exactly.
So I don't understand.
Have people spread out all over the goddamn Pacific.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Now, let me give you an example. Okay, using Jeff. Let's say Jeff Kenny's got a battalion. McManus's battalion, because I ran into Andy in Jalalabad in 2000.
Make it just XYZ battalion. Anybody.
Okay. He's got the Kunar, and his mission now is we want you guys to keep the Kunar in some kind of daggone order. Okay,
you're not talking about a pure conflict. You're talking about low intensity conflict.
No, I was talking about mixing because.
Don't go to Afghanistan. Okay. I won't do that.
All right, never mind. I'm just saying that you got to have people out there on the ground all the time who know the local folks, know what's going on. And that's just thinking you're going to parachute in, set up bases, shoot rockets, and parachute out. Where the hell are you going to do that at? I don't see it. I think you need to have somebody all the time out there that's integrated seamlessly within the Marine Corps system. The reason I was going to say Kenny and Jalalabad is because I was out there. If I was running aid and Kenny was running that and you throw in a special forces team, we could have given you Kunar. I guarantee you, not a problem within a couple of years. Place would have been fine. I guarantee it because I knew the area enough.
You're talking about a low-intensity conflict, not high-end peer-to-peer war.
Yeah, okay.
So you're talking apples and oranges, I think.
Because here's the thing. I don't think the Chinese can go launching missiles and sinking aircraft carriers in an unprovoked manner. There's got to be a reason that they can argue to the world.
Don't worry about the why and how. Right. Worry about that this thing has happened. Because the way you get there, you can get lost in that. I don't see this. I said, okay, fine. Then don't see it. Just this. There is a conflict. It started somewhere in the South China Sea region. Although you have an alternative therapy for that. So if it does start, right, this is Berger's construct as Marines, right, as an extension of the ship's magazine, integrated with the Navy. And he said, look, you've already seen us support the Navy by placing technology that we've developed as a Marine Corps on top of an amphibious ship that's transiting the Persian Gulf and be able to support, you know, naval operations. He said, we need to be more integrated like that so we can do stuff like that. Right. Because we have not had to, you know, there's that one part where he says what we have not had to we have not had to live with each other for a long time. We've been fighting a land war and two insurgencies, you know, in Asia. They've not played in those largely other than their EOD teams and their special warfare guys. You know, the Navy's been at sea and their aviation units have. But, you know, the Black Shoe Navy, for the most part, not participated. And so it's kind of interesting.
Well, I'm nervous at the thought of us not portraying ourselves as the nation's 911 force. I mean, granted, the 18th Airborne Corps can get
well. He doesn't say that though. So yeah. why would you think we wouldn't be able to be?
Because I can see the utility of putting detachments of Marines on black bottom ships. You know, with the Black Shoe Navy, I can see the utility of that, particularly if we have weapons that are enhanced more than just your average, you know, shoulder-fired weapons and stuff like that. I can see the utility, but what I don't like losing is exactly what Jeff was talking about last week, which is our own combined arms, because we do it better than anybody because we're all friggin' out of the same background.
Are those things mutually exclusive?
They're not mutually exclusive, but as much as I hated that stupid canned tax and whatnot, where the hell are you going to do that? You're not when you've got, you know, rifle companies spread all over the 7th Fleet. Jeez, and with some of those ships, that could be a danger in and of itself.
Well, what about...
Sorry.
No, I just... I don't know that those things are mutually exclusive, though. I mean, in your role as a generalist, you know, you probably ought to be capable in both skill sets, right? At big combined arms and also to be able to do naval expeditionary warfare, because the Marine Corps, you know, one would think if there was a conflict, you would have to do both. You would have to fight tonight, you know, dispersed operations, and then somehow or other you would have to mass the force, you know, somewhere in the area, or you'd have to get forces into the area even if they continued to be dispersed. So, and again, you know, one of the things he talked about was given modern lethality, right, it's a huge problem to get there once the fight is joined because, you know, you put them in ships and you're going to get a lot of people killed because of the lethality of modern weapon systems. So I mean, pretty interesting when he talks about, you know, it's a 30-year what does the Marine Corps need to look like in 30 years? And then we'll reverse engineer it from there. And so, yeah, so
Well, there's about to be a movie come out about back in a time when we knew we were going to lose carriers and sucked it up. And that's a whole different world now, isn't it? That Midway movie.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing. Here's the other thing. He talks about retaining the right people in a different career track and whatnot. And that's, I don't know how many times I've heard that in the past. That seems to me an iteration of something I've heard before. I'm not sure what he's talking about.
Explain what you think he means.
Well, the most simple level would be the Myers-Briggs test, which they give to every student at the Amphibious Warfare School, which breaks down people into different types of characteristics. The most common perceptively in the military was, I believe, was INTJ, which means intuitive but judgmental, and I forget what the other ones were. The most creative of the the combinations, at least according to the sociologists and whatnot, were severely underrepresented in the general officer population, but overrepresented in the general officer population, and that was the ENTP variant, of which Paul and I, we all tested ENTP. So we already have a system that seems to bring up some type of different sort of guy as far as organizational wise. Not quite so by the book, not the marionette, not guys who rely on their position and the rules with which to gain in compliance from individuals. You did it. Dave did it. We've all did it. We gained compliance because Marines friggin' thought we wanted to do what we're down with what we wanted. I mean, that's not how we work. But so you've already got a general officer corps that should be, if those stats are the same as they were 20 years ago, already a little bit eclectic, if you will, as far as military general officers go. I don't know how you screen and select for that as a system. How do you do that? It seems to already happen. To the limited extent it's going to happen, I should add.
Now, I thought that, you know, his whole talking about up or out, you know, that's been discussed for a long time, you know, that you know, the talent we lose by forcing people out that are competent, blah, blah, blah. But then I started thinking, so if, you know, I don't think competition for promotion gets really serious until you get to colonel.
Right.
In my opinion.
You know? Right. I agree.
And when I say colonel, I mean 06 colonel.
Right.
If you have a decent career, you will become a lieutenant colonel without much effort.
Right. Right? Correct.
And you may not be command selected, but you will have a decent career. And so who stays in if you can't get promoted, you know, below the rank of lieutenant colonel? Because at that point, you're retiring. So I don't know, at least on the officer side, I don't know that you want those guys around. I guess to me, they would have to be specifically designated, you know, people that you would say, no, this guy's good. He's not going to get promoted for this reason, but he's competent at these tasks. And so to that extent, keep him in. I didn't really understand. You know, I guess I would have to be more read into the manpower issue and how many people are you looking to retain? And because for people that you retain like that, now somebody's not going to get promoted that year because that guy stayed in. And maybe it's talent. So how much of that are you willing to accept? And I don't know enough about the manpower equation to get familiar with what he said. The other thing he talked about was the way we deliver education, the way we do manpower, is all based on the industrial age premises, and we need to get away from that. That why are we moving people? That now, you know, we used to move people when we didn't have dependents. Now we have dependents. If somebody likes the East Coast, why are we messing with them and saying, no, you got to go to the West Coast?
Other than nobody would ever leave Camp Pendleton, I'm with you on that.
The other thing is the way we deliver education. There's been a revolution in the way education is delivered around the country. and an explosion in distance learning, yet not so much in, you know, in the military. It still happens the same way. And he believes that that ought to change, and that we ought to change those requirements and blah, blah, blah. So I find that interesting as well. So, but right now there's been nothing concrete attached to the guidance, and that's supposedly on its way. So I'll be curious to see, you know, what exactly happens. What is his vision of the Marine Corps look like? Right.
Yeah.
And does it include things like tanks and tubed artilleries, or is that stuff traded off for other things that are more supportive of expeditionary warfare? And if it is traded off, where does the nation make up those tank battalions, those artillery batteries? Because you're going to need them if you ever go fight the fight that you don't intend to fight.
But he pointed out, again, how it seems that the services always get the defense budget fluctuates, but the way that the money's allocated pretty much stays consistent across the services. And if his strategy is adopted by all the Joint Chiefs, which is never going to happen, but if we do go to a maritime strategy, which is what I was talking about last week, that's got to change. I would be much happier for the this is crazy talk, but I'd be happier seeing him do exactly what he said he'll never do, which is start advocating for a bigger role for the Marine Corps, because we're cost efficient and it makes sense given we're a maritime power. And I would be much more comfortable with that approach, because a great reckoning is happening at some point in the near future with the money. And at that point, it's going to be a massacre. It's going to be like
secret station. I thought that one of the things he said that was interesting was, you know, we've been enamored with the most sophisticated, right, technology, and we can't buy very much of it. And so we need to buy lethal yet simpler, you know, end items, and we need more of them. Because in a great power competition, right, you know, I mean, look at the numbers of ships and planes that we produced, you know, for World War II. Mm-hmm. And so we've become tiny in terms of size. And part of that is we, you know, given the sophistication of the assets, we can't buy very much. We can't buy so much of it. And we need to be able to buy more. So I thought that, and we'll get Jeff on and we'll continue the discussion, but I thought that was a pretty interesting thing to say, as well as his advocacy of unmanned technology, you know, mm-hmm. that you're flying a section of F-35s, only one of them is manned, though, or F-35-like airplane, but only one of them is manned. You know, whoa.
I like that thinking, but
the same thing with sub-warfare, right? When you don't when you have these little things zooming around and they're all pinging and nobody's got to worry about them pinging, because you can blow up one of our drones. All you're going to do is give your position away. So go ahead, I dare you to, right? And so, I mean, to me, It put, like, you have these very, very high-end and expensive submarines. It's going to get blown out of the water by a little drone? Come on. That's so, you know, and drones, right, produce as many as you want. They're cheap. We'll launch them from tubed artillery. They'll hit the water. Poof, the system activates. Boom. You know, battery 4. We're looking for a sub. We're not sending a destroyer to look for it.
You should ask Alex if, like, a World War I triplane would survive in this high-tech environment, be virtually undetectable by the sophisticated stuff.
Right. Well, I mean,
could you imagine going back to, like, A1s and those kind of things for air support, because they're just a little bit more survivable? God, that'd be cool.
Well, I need to find some comm people to make me smart about how. If you assume that there's going to be assault, an electromagnetic assault where we poke each other's eyes out, then what happens? Are there lower orbiting things that we will launch that will serve as the military only, yada, 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 and we will defend those? And so I need to get up to snuff on that. I don't know enough about the comm architecture and how do you replicate it.
I read a little bit about it, and from what I was reading, the bigger threat is the jamming capability of being able to jam the signal. And I mean, there's obviously there's hunter killer satellites up there. I just don't know the probability of taking them all out in one fell swoop. That would probably require a nuke, I would imagine. It would have to, I would think.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about it. That almost shocked me. But somebody's got a bullet, or somebody's got technology that can zap them or move them, right? Just enough to make them not effective, or however you disable them.
All you would need would be a Carnival bumper car with a rocket on it, and just start bumping those things. in theory, I mean, you won't need anything sophisticated. You just need something to collide with it.
Yeah. So I'm curious now that we don't, like, knowing that that's the state of affairs. You know, do we launch our own lower orbiting satellites? Do we have a series of towers? How do we do that? Because target acquisition becomes huge. But anyway, General Burgers, I mean, all that stuff is very, very interesting. All right. Any final comments before I get rid of you?
No, brother. No, not at all. Not at all. I enjoy the conversation. I'm right back to where I was last week. I don't like giving up the MAGTAP. And I know you said it doesn't mean we're going to.
That's what I'm curious to see. You know, Berger's not stupid. He's been a Marine his whole life, right? He understands the power of the MAGTAF. You know, is the MAGTAF simply going to morph into, you know, it's still going to be the same thing, but we're not going to have this because it can't get to the battlefield. We're not going to have this because we are the nation's, right? We are the nation's, you know, naval expeditionary force, and we've got to be able to extend the magazine. In order for us to extend the magazine, we've got to get rid of this so we can get this. We can't do both, right? You know, so, but I don't see how the nation lives without the Marine Corps doing both. So that's what I'm curious to see.
Yeah, and I real quick, I want to ask a question and plug a book real quick. I just finished Rough Men Stand Ready by Stan Courier, who's an Anglico guy, the reserve outfit up there in Long Beach. He was in 2003, went on the march up there. He was attached to the British, the Royal Irish Regiment specifically. Right. Interesting book. Real quick, though. Did you have a mosquito bar when you deployed over to Iraq? Did you have those mosquito nets, you know, the jackets that you would impermeate with that industrial strength stuff and put them on and things like that?
For mosquitoes?
Yeah, for mosquitoes. I'm just asking a question.
No.
Okay, so one of the things that I'm reading about that I find a few things of interest, and one of them is how they get tortured by mosquitoes and whatnot. And he talks about having read about Mesopotamia campaigns in World War I with the Brits, in which, if memory serves, the Brits lost hundreds of thousands to disease, and much more to disease and heat than anything else. That was the biggest problem, was mosquitoes. And I never went in the Westpac on our deployments without a mosquito bar I never carried a tent. I would carry a mosquito bar and one of those damn jackets. I think they're leftover, they're like hemp fiber, loose things that you would impregnate with mosquito and then put them on. And I bet you those things are gone. And I just wonder about that sometimes because they sucked it up and just got inside of sleeping bags and just didn't sleep because they couldn't take the mosquitoes. But, man, you could have got a lot of disease that way getting trapped out there with no mosquito net.
I don't think they were there long enough, and I don't think the fighting lasted long enough for them to get bit very much. So, and then in the spring, you know, the cold weather, I think you don't live with that.
Oh, no, that guy was tortured weeks on end.
Oh, he said he was?
Weeks on end with those damn mosquitoes. Till finally somebody sent them a mosquito nets from home. No. I'm like, dude, Andrew, come on, guy. I just thought that was weird because you lose I don't think a grunt that's used to operating that area would be anywhere without a way to keep the mosquitoes off you. It's just too easy not to have to deal with them, you know. I just thought that was weird. For some reason, that stuck in my mind. But the book itself, by the way, is an excellent read. Very entertaining. Not a lot of the sugarcoating. I was there. We did all this. It's a very entertaining look into an asset that people don't even understand because the poor guy, they're Anglican. They spent like 3 weeks sitting on the border of Iran waiting to see if anybody was coming across, you know, shit like that. It's an interesting, introspective book, and it's well worth the time to read. So I just wanted to plug that because he's he's a Facebook friend. I don't believe I ever ran into Stan on active duty, but Stan Coyer, C-O-E-R-R, Rough Man Stan Ready. It's a good read.
Got it. All right, man. Yeah. Have a great day.
Thanks, buddy.
Yep, there you have it. Tim Lynch here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. Jeff Kenny working today, so that'll do it. If you missed the first hour, don't touch the dial. You can hear about my trip to 29 Palms yesterday, doing post-traumatic winning for 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. Got to see Lieutenant Colonel Gabe Diana again, and very impressed with them as an organization. So, yeah, it was an awesome day. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. Have a great Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow. The Shuffle join us. And then Expeditionary Week next week. So see what happens. Have a great one. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.